Welcome to CBS Sports Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Moore. You can find me on Twitter at MattMooreCBS, or if you want to hear me argue about a meaningless call that did not wind up affecting anything when LeBron did or did not travel or palm the ball last night, you can follow me at HP Basketball. Joining me right now is Brad Bakken. He's the NBA editor at CBS Sports. He joins me now. We're going to talk about the finals and a quick preview of that, obviously, because we all know where Cavs Celtics is headed, right? And then we're also going to start by talking about the Celtics, because the Celtics are in a really interesting spot. I had a piece this week talking about kind of what their options are with the number one pick, if they keep it, what are the upsides and downsides of that, if they trade it, if so, then for whom? And Brad Bakken wrote something earlier last week about how they need to trade Isaiah Thomas, so I thought he'd be a good guy to have on, and we could talk a little bit about that kind of stuff. So, Brad, I guess, like, let's start here. It really kind of comes down to how much Danny Ainge believes in this core. And I think the big thing is GMs tend to get attached to teams that they have success with. Like, I've just seen it all the time. They really start to believe in players that do well for them and play well for them. They buy into them, and the better they are, the more they buy into them. It's why I think that Danny Ainge, like, people around Boston have said, you know, don't expect him to get rid of Avery Bradley. He loves Avery Bradley. Bradley's been great for them, and he loves that kid. And I'm like, okay, well, if they keep him, they can't keep Isaiah Thomas. Well, you know, Isaiah's really endeared himself to the organization. I'm like, you can't keep everybody. You can't keep everybody if you can't even keep everybody and keep the guys that are on this team now. Like, if you make that decision, Kelly Olynyk's gone this summer. If you make that decision, Marcus Smart's gone next summer. And it means that you're locked into long-term deals for two guards with Markelle Fultz coming in. And it pretty much locks you out, if you're going to go that route, of getting Paul George. That means you're not going to be able to sign him next summer. So, to me, a lot of this just comes down to how much Danny Ainge is emotionally invested in the success that this team has had.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the Celtics are as close as probably maybe two, three teams beneath the Cavs and the Warriors. I think there's reason to believe in the Celtics and this core. I don't know exactly who will compose that core after they get through this summer, but I think the bulk of it will still be in place. I think there's reason enough to believe in whatever that kind of core ends up being. They have so many like players that I think any group, five or six of them, could reasonably still constitute this same core that they're playing with. I think Danny Ainge is probably right to believe in what he's invested in and believe in the foundation that he set and the versatility of his roster. I think you're right, though. I think the question comes down to what they do with Isaiah. I don't think they necessarily have to trade Isaiah. I just think that it's clear that he can't be the best player. So there's a number of options that they can have to fix that. I think Gordon Hayward really is the X factor here. If they get Hayward in free agency, they don't have to give anything up to that. And after that, it just becomes whether you want to pay Isaiah Thomas what he's going to get on the open market and be paying him upwards of probably $30 million when he's, what, 32, 33, 34 years old. I think you kind of can decide that independent of your team building. Do you really think that he's going to be worth that money 3 years from now? But if they get Hayward, I think this team, I mean, you saw the way they are capable. I mean, in the end, they fell short last night just because they can't score enough ultimately without Thomas. But the Cavs are the highest barometer that you can measure yourself against right now. And there are, for stretches, they can play with that team. So I think one more legitimate scorer with Thomas as a two is a reasonable team that you can keep building around. I think if they don't get Hayward, that's when it starts to get interesting, because then you have to go out and kind of make over your team by giving certain things up to get others. And that's, so I think Hayward is the X factor.
Well, I've got a couple of disagreements. So I think one, I don't think they're that close. And the listener to this podcast will not be surprised that I have that opinion. But I mean, yeah, they won game three because Isaiah was out and they caught him off guard and a bunch of things went their way. They hung around in game four. They do that pluckiness and just making plays, and LeBron had another bad half before he kind of straightened out in the second half. But, you know, the reality is that game two, they suffered the worst loss in franchise playoff history going back to 1947. And this team got the number one seed, but if you always have to look at context. It's like, look, Kyle Lowry got hurt. If Kyle Lowry doesn't get hurt, the Raptors had like a four-game lead on them. the Raptors probably finish one, and then the Celtics go two, and the Cavs go three. And then you're talking about a second round out, because the Cavs would have wiped the floor with them in the second round, and things look entirely different. But it didn't, and that's fine. But still, you have to look at kind of the context. They went seven games to the Wizards, and you either think the Wizards are really good, and in which case I would say that the Wizards have the capacity to keep getting better. They have a bona fide superstar in John Wall on both ends of the floor, and Bradley Beal's good, and Otto Porter's good, and they're going to keep getting better and be at least right there with the Celtics. Or you think that the Wizards are not that good, and then in which case you're saying, well, okay, the Celtics went to seven games with the Wizards, so it's either, you know, the Wizards are good and they're just as good as the Celtics, or the Wizards are not good, in which case the Celtics are just as good as the Wizards and being not good. So it's one or the other. I think there's a really big gap between the Cavs and where the Celtics need to be, and I'm not sure that Hayward fills that gap. Now, I've caped for Hayward in the past. I really was skeptical of him being a max player when he signed that deal 2-3 years ago. But since then, I've loved what he's done. Like, he was phenomenal in Utah. Not this past season, but the year before that. He was just incredible, and he was still great this year. He can rebound, he can defend, he can shoot, he can score off the dribble, he can get to the rim, he doesn't complain, he's a good locker room guy. Like, there's just a million reasons to like Gordon Hayward. But I don't look at Gordon Hayward and say, who are you bringing to the table? Well, we're bringing LeBron and Kyrie and Love. Who are you bringing to the table? Well, we're bringing a dude that can't ride Space Mountain, and we're bringing Gordon Hayward and Al Horford. No, you got a nice team, but if you ask me, like, is Isaiah Thomas, Al Horford, Gordon Hayward significantly better than what the Hawks brought to the table in, like, 2015 with Paul Millsap and Al Horford, who was better then because he was younger, and Jeff Teague, who actually played really well that season, along with Korver and all the other guys? I think it's debatable. Like, it's pretty close. And we're still talking about trying to clear an enormous gap there. So I don't see how Hayward is going to get him all the way there. Now, if they trade for Paul George, okay, maybe. If they trade for Paul George and this becomes Paul George's team, all right. But I keep looking at it and going, why not just build around Fultz? Like, just Fultz, Jaylen Brown, whoever they get with the 2018 pick, Yabusele, who's overseas and going to be, you know, he's going to be really good, though he's missing Summer League again this year with a foot injury, and Zizek. You have real assets there. You got real talent there. And you can really project to be something in a couple of years when LeBron finally slows down, because he, yes, will eventually slow down. But I don't see any way that they're going to take this core and be able to match LeBron without an injury happening. But I do get the idea of you basically saying, well, look, let's draft Fultz and keep him. Let's contend right now. If LeBron suffers an injury, we sneak into the finals, and then it's a great season. But then I just keep going, okay, yeah, but then you have the Warriors, and that's a whole other problem.
Yeah, I mean, you made this point earlier in the year, and I agree with it. I think that if you measure your team building on can we beat the Warriors and can we beat the Cavs as currently constructed, then almost any move anyone makes is moot. You know, I don't think you can just say, well, we're still not going to be good enough to beat the Cavs, so therefore let's scrap everything we've been doing for the last 3 years, get a whole new plan together with the number one pick this year, and start for 4 years down the road again. I mean, they have been building since they got those picks from Brooklyn. They've been building for this time period. Isaiah Thomas became more than they thought they were going to, than anyone thought he was going to be, and so that has expedited it some. But they are, like I said, they are one of the teams that are in that next tier behind the Cavs and the Warriors. I think the Wizards can reasonably become a team that can reasonably compete. They are not one move away from competing with the Cavs and Warriors, but they can get closer. The Celtics can get closer. The Rockets can get closer. The Spurs can get closer. Okay, so any of these teams, I think that they can close that gap, and I think obviously the Celtics have the most options available to them to make significant strides this offseason. I think that can't be argued. So to me, again, you take Fultz, okay. And now if you get Hayward in free agency, now you have a decision to make. You either keep Fultz and you go out and you're a markedly better team than you were this year simply with Hayward and Thomas. Okay? But so you can sort of plan for the future with Fultz and still be a better team next year. Not as good as the Cavs, but a team that can reasonably compete with them. Or at that point you can say, "Hey, we got Hayward and Thomas, our window is now," and you can go out and get Butler or George for Fultz. And now if you're trying to tell me that a Hayward, George, Thomas team can't reasonably compete with any team in the NBA, I would hugely disagree with you. So, again, I just think it all comes back to Hayward. You play for free agency. If you get him, now you're deciding between keeping Fultz and not completely mortgaging your future, or going all in right now and trading Fultz for a Butler or George, even with the uncertainty that George could leave after a year, and saying, we can win right now. And I believe that team could win. So, I think it just comes back to whether or not you get Hayward. If you don't get Hayward, okay, then you're not going to be good enough to beat the Cavs next year anyway. Okay, so then you're deciding between, if you don't get Hayward, then I think it's time to start thinking about dealing Isaiah Thomas, because he can't be the best player on the team. So I would go out and I would try to use him to get a star that's more capable of being the top guy. And when Fultz is ready, those two guys are ready to win. That's how I would play it.
I think part of the issue is that it sounds like a pretty good plan, but the problem is, Hayward's going to make 25 mil. He's going to make $25 million this summer. He's going to get paid $25 million at least per year, if not more, depending on what kind of a deal he takes. I assume he's going to take the max because he's going to be one of the best free agents on the market, and he's in his prime, and he's an all-star caliber player. And if we've seen other guys get those kind of maxes, then definitely Gordon Hayward's going to take it. So you're talking about $25 to $30 million for him. And that takes up a huge chunk of their available, the max cap space that their fans are always talking about. So then if you're like, all right, well, we're going to trade for Paul George on top of it so that we can get him, and then we can re-sign him, so we don't have to, because they're not, if they do that, they will not have room to then sign George as a free agent. So they're going to get him. They have to go trade for him. Okay, well, so what are you going to send? You send Jay Crowder, the 2018 pick, or Fultz, one or the other, not both. You throw in, Jalen Drobko's gone. He's not eligible. You can throw in Marcus Smart. That gets you to 11. You're still going to need another $5 million. So you're talking about like, hey, Pacers, will you take Tyler Zeller, Jay Crowder, and Marcus Smart along with the 2018 first round pick for Paul George? And the Pacers in that situation are probably saying, we're going to talk to the Lakers because the Lakers are going to send us D'Angelo Russell and Julius Randle and some sort of future pick.
Like, well, the Lakers would be stupid to do that, because the Lakers are the best play is to wait to get him in free agency. That would be ridiculous, to mortgage all of their whatever assets they do have to go get a guy that you're probably the leading candidate to get a year from now.
But if they know that Boston's going to get him and they're worried about Boston getting him and then him winning and being like, I love it here, I'm signing, like, that's your opportunity. Like, that's why the Pacers need to be engaging those two teams, and they need to play them off of each other. Because Boston needs Paul George in order to become an elite team with this core that they want to believe in, and the Lakers need Paul George because he's a rare superstar that legitimately wants to play for their woebegotten franchise.
I think the difference is the Lakers have to get him, because you can't win in the NBA without a bona fide superstar. The probably two or three of them. The Celtics, it would be great to get George, but there are plays that they can still become an elite team without George. And so they aren't as desperate. The Lakers have to get George or someone of the like. Not these guys. They're going to pick Lonzo Ball. D'Angelo Russell's going to improve. Randall's going to. There's no way that the assets they have right now are just going to organically get good enough for them to be anything meaningful. Everyone knows they've got to go out and get big names, probably two or three of them. So they're in a different place than the Celtics. It would be great if they got George, but there's no way anyone's going to tell me that Jimmy Butler and Gordon Hayward as the core of a team. If you trade, say, Isaiah Thomas, if you include him in a package with the 2018 pick to get Jimmy Butler, if you're telling me that a team that's set up with Markelle Fultz and Avery Bradley and Jimmy Butler and Gordon Hayward and Al Horford isn't a top three team in the league, you're crazy. That's a really, really, really good team, sans George. So I just think it's a different scenario. I think George is obviously the best player of all that group that we just talked about, and if they could get him, it'd be great. I'd be hesitant to strike a deal for George, because I don't care what he tells me verbally, there's no way I would want to risk him leaving in a year, because you've built too much here. You've built up too much equity to have it all go away for George to just go re-sign or go sign with the Lakers a year from now. I'd be hesitant with George.
Yeah, and see, my thing is, it's the Breaking Bad thing. No half measures. That's my thing, okay? It's either we believe in this core, all right, then let's take our shot. Like, let's take our legit shot. And, like, you believe in your culture and how much the players love it there, and you're the Boston Celtics and you have 17 championships. Okay, well, go prove it. Like, risk losing him to go win now. if you're like, well, I don't want to take that risk. Okay, well, if you're not willing to take that risk, that means you don't really believe in this core that much. And if you don't really believe in this core that much, that's fine. But plan for the future, chill out, take a step back. I think their best plan is honestly play out the next 2 years, re-sign Avery, trade Isaiah, and then build around Fultz and whatever you get in return for Isaiah, because you can get young players and picks and then really build something for the future that's going to be sustainable versus this core, which is very much like it's kind of pieced together. It's, you know, oh, hey, Isaiah Thomas was like a cast off in Phoenix, and now he's scoring a whole lot. And, you know, Al Horford was a great get. But it's also like Horford's also part of this complication. The good thing for Boston, I think, is they don't face the issue that a lot of franchises do where they have to worry about the cap. Like, that ownership group will go into the luxury tax and pay bajillions of dollars if they were to put together. If they can pull off the pieces in sequential order, they'll just pay the luxury tax on those teams if they really think that that's a championship caliber team. And that's a huge advantage they've got over teams like Memphis and a lot of those franchises that are kind of sub under that elite tier. I mean, even San Antonio degree. San Antonio is very careful with their cap spending, with their tax spending, because the market's just not that good. And the Celtics know that they can afford to be risky and overpay for some guys for a couple of years.
The risk in doing what you're saying and in playing out the string the next 2 years and building around Fultz is it always looks good on paper, and it sounds good to say we're going to get a bunch of these young guys and we're going to let them grow into each other. But realistically, at some point, you have to go out and make a move for an established player. So if they do that and they wait 2 years and say, we're going to build around Fultz, well, then whatever that new core is 2 or 3 years from now is still going to have to go out and acquire. There's no way that Avery Bradley and Markel Fultz are going to just like organically grow into a team that's suddenly more competitive than this current team. They're going to have to go get their own superstar, whoever that is,
right,
3 years from now. So you're not really doing anything differently. You're just starting over the same exact process that you already started 3 years ago. You're just doing it over.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the answer is just I get the half measure thing, but I really do think in this case the answer is in the middle. I think because of the way that Ainge has set it up, they can play both ways. They can get Fultz and still add a second star to their roster right now, and then at that point they're playing it both ways. They're still not good enough to compete with the Cavs, but they're better than pretty much every other team besides the Cavs or the Warriors. And they're also set up for the future with Fultz. And at that point, then they can make the all-or-nothing decision if we're going to add a third star, because the third star is what puts you in that realm. So you decide at that point if we're ready to go try to compete with LeBron right now. And in that case, I could very strongly make an argument to go get Paul George and mortgage it all. I would do that then. But two stars with this team around it is not is nothing to sniff at. I think it all comes back to Hayward, because anybody else that they get, they're going to have to give up too much of what they've built. Not too much, I would still do it, but a lot of what they've built to go get it. Hayward, in terms of basketball, comes for free. You don't have to lose anything to get him. And so he's the X factor for me, and I think they're going to get him. I really do. I really think he's going to Boston.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't buy into my experience is that players, like, I guess here's kind of the thing. Do you really want to go spend all your time in your 20s with a guy that you hung out with when you were like a teenager? Because that's the kind of thing is, if he goes to Boston, it's just he's going to get inundated with all of the talk of Brad Stevens. There's going to be like constant conversations, and he doesn't really get to be his own dude. Like, he's always going to be that guy that played for Brad Stevens, and he's not going to be the star on that team. He's not going to be the best player on that team. He's not going to be the leader on that team. That's Isaiah. So, like, it's basically, do you want to go be a sidekick who's also like the coach's pet in Boston, or do you want to stay and make your mark in Utah and make more money?
What mark is he making in Utah?
I mean, they're good.
Utah's in the same exact place as Boston is.
I agree.
They're going nowhere without them getting a free. And who's signing in Utah?
Nowhere. No one. That's fair.
No one. Gordon Hayward's not going anywhere in Utah. And I think you make a little too much of how I think that today's player, I think it's pretty obvious that they've changed. And I think we all have to accept that these guys aren't quite as worried as we think they are about being the guy. We just said the same thing about Kevin Durant. Do you want to go to Golden State and be second fiddle to Steph Curry? Like, that was stupid at the time. It looks even stupider now. He doesn't care. he doesn't even play second fiddle. He's the best player on the team. You know, it works out with today's player. They're not as worried about that. So I don't think there's any part of Gordon Hayward that's, if he's sitting here in a boardroom and somebody's making a pitch to him to go play for the Celtics, I don't think there's even 1% of his mindset devoted to, do I really want to be a part of Isaiah Thomas's team? There's no way that's even factoring in. And frankly, he's not going to be the best player on a championship team anywhere. So anywhere he goes that he wants to go win, he has to know in his most honest private thoughts, I can't be the best player on a championship team. So anywhere he goes, he's going to have to be on somebody else's team. I don't think that's a factor at all.
Yeah, but I think there is a big difference between being like, oh, I'm not the best player on LeBron's team, or, oh, I'm not the best player on Steph Curry's team, or, oh, I'm not the best player on...
First of all, I think he would be the best player on the Celtics, first of all.
Okay.
Better than Isaiah. I think you do, too.
Oh, I agree, but it's, like, Isaiah's still going to be, like, the name, the brand, the franchise. And I think that stuff does matter. I think players are prideful. I think that's always been true. I think the Warriors sold KD on the fact that he didn't have to give up anything. He didn't have to give up anything. He's still the man. Like, he's still revered. Like, he's still, and he's the best player on the team. Like, they made that sacrifice for him, which is a credit to them. But I think that's kind of a factor. Hey guys, it's summer. You're going to want to get out. You're going to want to go to concerts. You're going to want to go to games, baseball games. You want to catch the NBA playoffs. And to do that, the best way to do that is with SeatGeek. I'm going to tell you how you can get $20 back on your first purchase just by listening to this podcast. SeatGeek is the smartest way for you to find tickets wherever you are. Their app is incredible. I've got it on my phone. It's by far the easiest way I found to buy tickets for anything I want to go see. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can find the seats that I'm looking for. The best thing is they are going to search multiple ticket sites, okay? They're not just going to look and pull from their own distributors. They're going to find you the best across multiple sites to make sure that you get the most value, and they're going to make sure you get the most bang for your buck, because when you look at these tickets, they're going to give you a grade, and they're going to let you know exactly how good those seats are for what the venue is, what the event is, how much are you paying, or is this actually good value for you so you can be smart with your money. Plus, all of their tickets come with a 100% guarantee so you can shop with confidence. Best of all, like I said, my listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get the $20 rebate, here's all you got to do. Download the SeatGeek app. And go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. Enter promo code IEYE, as in the CBS logo, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first purchase. Download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code I today. Speaking of Durant, let's talk about Warriors Cavs, because it looks like we're gonna get the big rematch that everybody, the three match that everybody wants, that, well, a lot of us are skeptical about being competitive. So you were a Warriors fan. But you have been very consistent throughout the year that whenever I say, I don't know, I'm kind of worried the Warriors are just going to beat the crap out of them, you've been like, I don't know how anybody can doubt LeBron. Like, I don't know how anybody can doubt LeBron after what he's shown and what he's done. And it's an interesting question of, can one guy be that much better than any combination of players? It goes kind of against the whole idea of, like, a team to a degree. It's almost like all the other guys are inconsequential because it's just – how good is LeBron? They're obviously, the Cavaliers are obviously really good, from Kyrie to Love to Tristan Thompson to all these guys. But it is an interesting question of, I guess, can one dude impact a basketball game not just more than any other, because that's obviously true, but can he impact it so much that it outweighs four guys in the top 15 of the league?
Well, I think you touched on it. One, we tend to look at... We tend to look at these matchups too much in the big picture, I think. So we look at the roster on paper and we think, like, the Warriors are just stacked with more talent, right? But on any given day, Kyrie Irving can be the best player on the floor. On any given day, Kevin Love can be the best player on the floor. LeBron James is almost always the best player on the floor. So forget the big picture of who we think overall has more talent on paper. In game two, on June 4th, or whenever it is, the Cavs have three guys that can take that game over. They have three bona fide superstars. Look what Kyrie Irving did last night. They have three bona fide superstars that are capable of playing at a superstar level in any game. Now, it's hard to call Kevin Love a superstar now because he's taken such a back seat. But in any given game, he can be a superstar. So they have three guys that can play at superstar level, and then they have some really good supporting pieces. They can stretch the floor. They shoot the hell out of the three. So they've got what? The Warriors have one more all-star? So how is that difference not made up in the fact that the Cavs have the best player maybe ever? They have one more all-star. It's not like when they're playing the Jazz and you're running out Gordon Hayward against Durant, Curry, Thompson, and Green.
Don't forget Rudy Gobert. Come on now.
You're running out four all-stars versus three. And LeBron James can make up a gap like that.
Yeah, I think he can. I think the problem is largely the team concept. You know, as I just keep coming back to how good the Warriors are as a team, and this is, you know, I will admit this, like, yes, it is disgusting how much talent the Warriors have, and it's really kind of gross that they got Durant on top of all the other stuff, the guys that they have. But look, what makes the Warriors amazing, and what made Draymond into what he is, and Klay Thompson into what he is how the Warriors play together as a team under Steve Kerr. That's what's made them go from, hey, this is a really good team that knocked off the Nuggets and then lost to the Clippers in the first round the next year, to, oh my God, is this the best team of all time, is the way that they play together. And it's not just those guys, but it's Andre Iguodala, and it's Sean Livingston, and now it's Ian Clark, and it's, God help me, JaVale McGee, and it's all of these guys together versus the Cavs, where it's like, it's very clearly like Kyrie and LeBron, and then like some of Love, who like fills in the gaps when everybody's worried about those other dudes, and then just like a bunch of shooters and Tristan Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're reducing that a little too much.
Am I? Because why I'm asking, like, because this is the thing is when I watch when I watch Kevin Love, you know, I notice like he's never like, it's not like it was in Minnesota where it's like their teams are scheming for him. Like, teams are petrified of Kyrie and LeBron, understandably, and then Love's making them pay. It's like Chris Bosh, and that doesn't mean that, I mean, Chris Bosh, I think, is a Hall of Famer based off of what he did in Miami, and he was way better than what Kevin Love has been for the Cavaliers. But Kevin Love's been damn good this year. Even on the defensive end, he's been really good this year, which is, this is the best defense I've ever seen him play. Love's phenomenal. His passing is great. But in terms of, like, real guys that you have to be constantly worried about, how many of them do they have? Versus the Warriors, I feel like you're constantly worried about everybody because of how they play. I feel like this is really weird that I'm defending the Warriors to you. This is a weird change.
Saying that the Cavs, I'm just simply saying don't underestimate the Cavs. This is not, I'm not somehow knocking the Warriors and what they do. I just think that it's, look, it. The only reason that teams aren't scheming for Kevin Love is because they have to scheme for Kyrie and LeBron. And that dynamic isn't going anywhere. So you could sit here and say, oh, well, Love's just benefiting from all the attention that the other two guys are getting. Well, that's not going to change. Whatever the case is, and he's become a lot more now than that spot-up corner shooter, floor spacer, sort of just a misfit. He's actually becoming a guy that can control possessions. They're going to him possession after possession during certain stretches. He's getting the ball in the post. He's starting to get double teams a few times now. He's actually being a focal point of the offense for stretches. I'm not saying that teams are game planning for him, but he's actually a guy now that's getting back to, on certain possessions, a number one option guy. He's playing really, really good. And I would not – it was very easy to fall into the camp of Kevin Love's never been on a winner. And then when he came to Cleveland, he fell into the shadows. And it's very easy to forget how good he is. Like, Kevin Love is a superstar level talent. Superstar. And I believe that wholeheartedly. And so I wouldn't fall into the trap of, I think he got, the perception in Minnesota was we sort of downplayed his individual accomplishments because he didn't win. And then when he got to Cleveland, he won. And we downplayed it because he didn't have the individual accomplishments. And the truth is, in any given game, and certainly in any given stretch of a game, Kevin Love can be the best player on the floor. That's I don't think that's debatable. So the Cavs are stacked, is what I'm saying. And around three, probably Hall of Famers, the Cavs have three Hall of Famers. They have one of the best three-point shooters ever. Iman Shumpert is shooting. J.R. Smith is quietly like a really good role player these days. Like, you're sort of just reducing this to, oh, they have a few pieces. They don't have a few pieces. They got a lot of pieces. And the Warriors have a lot of pieces. I think it's going to be a tremendous series. And it better be, because the playoffs have sucked. And this is all this year's been about. Aside from some sideshows, we got some crazy stats by Russell Westbrook, and James Harden had a kind of a turnaround year. It was fun with D'Antoni. But this whole thing, if we don't get Cavs-Warriors, and an epic Cavs-Warriors at that, I don't know. This season's been pretty boring.
I've liked the season. I like the regular season. The regular season I thought was really interesting, is because part of that is, like, I just, like, tuned out Warriors and Cavs. I was just like, well, we kind of know what we're getting, and I didn't really worry about it. So I got caught up in those other things. I got caught up in, you know, Westbrook and the MVP race, and I got caught up into how good the Rockets are, and I got caught up in, you know, can the Spurs really sustain this, and the Wizards and the Jazz and the Grizzlies kind of foibles. Like, I just thought there was a lot of interesting teams this year that played, and I thought the level of play was high too. Like, I just think that the level of play right now is really high. I've seen years where the games have just sucked. The games were great. The storylines and the level of competition relative to the top made for a sense of inevitability, which I agree was a drag. But I enjoyed it in the moment. But, you know, when you look back, you always remember the playoffs. It's what you remember. Like, you remember the playoffs, and we're going to remember crappy playoffs followed by whatever happens in the finals. So that, I agree with you. Last thing before we go, I want to touch on this. Last year you mentioned something in the finals where, like, LeBron, like, had good games and, like, good, he had good numbers, but, like, he just wasn't taking over in the first four games of the finals. And you were like, I know he can do this. Why doesn't he? And we were like, well, you know, they're scheming him this way, and Draymond and this, that, and the other. And then he just turned it on in Game 5 and turned it on even higher in Game 6, and then had a really phenomenal all-around game in Game 7, leading to the greatest comeback in NBA history. I was talking to a Cavs fan last night that's a friend of mine, and he mentioned, he said this. He was like, it drives me crazy. He said, for me, it's about LeBron. I want him to be the best ever. And so it's frustrating when he plays like this. I just can't understand it. Like, there are times when in Game 3 and the first half of Game 4, LeBron said after Game 3, he's like, I just didn't have it. And that quote's been rattling around in my brain, because players...
Sick! It was sick!
Like, players say that all the time, right? I just didn't have it. But I don't get how you don't have it in a playoff game.
Okay, so I have a lot of thoughts on this. I think it boils down to this. I think LeBron's natural approach to a basketball game, his sort of default pace, is to get everybody involved, to let the pace and the circumstances of the game dictate his own aggression. He knows he can get his shot and his points whenever he needs to, and I think he's one of the great orchestrators of all time because of that sort of default setting. Compare that to a guy like Kobe, whose default setting is to play every game and as a scorer, as if it's Game 7 and I have nobody else on my team. That's how he naturally plays. And for Kobe to go into a game and let's say the matchup dictates that the Lakers are going to be better off with him moving the ball, he's got to make a conscious decision from the tip of that game to move the ball. And on every possession, he's got to remind himself to do it. And every time he slips, he's going to fall back into his default mode of going and getting buckets. And LeBron is the other way. He has to remind himself on every possession, if he's going to be a scorer, he has to actually change the way he thinks. And like most things in life, you sort of fall back into what's comfortable. And I think this is kind of a psychology thing. I don't think it means that he doesn't have the Michael Jordan killer instinct. I don't think that it means he doesn't care or he's not trying. I think those are all stupid conspiracy theories. I think it's simple that his natural instinct as a player is to not be assertive from the get-go, to feel things out, to get everybody involved. And most of the time, that's good. That works. He's obviously won a lot of basketball games doing that. He's become, I think, probably the greatest player ever playing like that. But in certain matchups, he has to change his whole DNA. and the Warriors are one of those matchups. He has to score. He has to attack to beat the Warriors. And you saw it last year in the finals. I think any game that he was under 30 points, they lost. I might be wrong on this, but I think it's something. There's some number of points that when he was under it, they lost, and when he was over it, they won. And LeBron might be this not only the best basketball player ever, he might be the smartest basketball player ever. He knows this. And so that's why it's so hard to understand in games one and two where he's scoring 20 points and he's 7 for 18 from the field. He has to know that that's not good enough to win. And the way you know that he knows that is when it came down to it, he played differently. When he had no other choice, he played differently. And so I think it's just a case of he has to – it's not natural for him to play that way. And he has to remind himself so often that he's going to have slip-ups. And if you have too many slip-ups – and you fall out of rhythm, then suddenly a game gets away from you. And I sort of think that's how it happens, that it is a constant mental struggle to remind himself to play in a way that he's not as comfortable playing. And if you fall out of that rhythm too often, you get out of rhythm for an entire game. And I think that over the course of his career, you've seen a handful of games where he's done that. But yes, I do believe that. And again, I want to be clear with this. It's not. I remember when we were all arguing about why isn't LeBron dominating last year. LeBron can't just decide to dominate. Nobody can do that. He can't just say, "Well, I'm going to score 40 points tonight. I'm going to make 70% of my shots tonight." The only thing he can decide is to attack in a way that can lead to that result. He can be aggressive to score first. And if the shots aren't going in, the shots aren't going in. You know, if I look up at the thing that baffles you about LeBron is when you look up and he's 2 for 10. Like Kobe's going to be 2 for 27. You know, and in these matchups where he has to score like that, I think nobody would have a problem with LeBron being 2 for 25. Nobody would say LeBron choked. Nobody would say LeBron doesn't have the killer instinct. Like he attacked in the way he needed to. He just wasn't making shots. No, nobody can just decide to make shots. That comes and goes. But the ones that are hard to swallow are the games where he's sort of roaming around the perimeter. He gets up 17 shots, like he did in Game 3, which may have been because he was sick, but that's not the first time that's ever happened. That's the problem. And I don't think he'll do that against the Warriors this year. I don't think he's going to wait to be in a 3-1 hole to decide, okay, you know, Draymond Green's a great defender. Warriors, they play great team defense. They switch all these theories. Like, no, I'm going to go score. And I think he knows that this year. And I think for that reason, it's going to be a hell of a finals.
Yeah. I think his biggest thing, I've always said this, he's such a cerebral guy, which people kind of miss with the fact that he's an athlete, but he overthinks things. Like, he really does, I think, overthink things. That's how the Spurs really flummoxed him in 2013. It's part of how the Mavericks froze him in 2011. The Warriors just dragged him down in 2015. They just sent body after body after body, and we're just going to throw all of this stuff at you, and you don't have Kyrie and Love, and we're just going to wear you down your efficiency. I think he tends to overthink things when he can't figure out a defense, where he's like, maybe this is the right decision, but maybe this is the right decision. All right, let's try something else, and maybe there'll be a more obvious decision. And it's like, no, man. Like, the obvious decision is you're LeBron James.
That's right.
Go do you. And when he plays instinctively, this is kind of what I got into last year when we started talking about this, is like, when he plays instinctively, he's just a holy terror. He's just a nightmare. Like, he takes over these games. 2012 versus the Celtics, he just played instinctively. He was just like, I'm open, I'm going to shoot the jumper, bang. And he made shots, sure, but he was locked in that night, and he just played instinctively. The last three games of the finals last year, he just played instinctively. He just went out and was just like, I'm not going to think about it, I'm just going to play, because he didn't have any choice. Yeah. And when he did that, like, that's when he is the best player maybe of all time. Like, that's when he is the best player of all time. That's maybe kind of where I'm at with him, with the versus Jordan debate, is I still lean Jordan because there was never a time when Jordan was not there. There was never a time Jordan.
I think we romanticize that a bit. I mean, I think if you
just what you said, he had bad games. I don't deny that he had bad games, because if you went back, you can find them very easily. Jordan had a lot of bad games. But Jordan had very few games where you would just be like, well, he just didn't have it and, like, wasn't aggressive enough. Like, that was just never the case.
Yeah.
You know? And if you combine how overpowering he was when he did have it, and when he was locked in and the shots were falling, and that, I think, is what led to this feeling of that LeBron, that Jordan was always going to win. You always felt the shots were going to go down. You always felt that Jordan was going to win. And it was just like, this is what's going to happen because he's Michael Jordan. With LeBron, there's always a question. Like, even now, like, he's the best player on the planet. And yes, he's facing an all-time random outlier occurrence of a team. But we're still sitting here wondering, hey, is the best player in the world going to be able to win this series? And, like, I don't know how many games I'm going to pick.
He doesn't have to win. I think your point about the 15 finals that the Warriors won.
Yeah.
I think that's when LeBron had to do it himself.
Yep.
And for a couple games he did. And I think he knew that there was no denying it in that series. There was absolutely no backup. So from game one on, they were playing through him and he was basically isolating every possession. And I think last year, you know, he had Love. He had Irving, and so he wasn't thinking like that from the get-go. He waited until, okay, even with Love and Irving, I'm down 3-1, I gotta go. The Jordan debate is interesting. I mean, we're about to be inundated with legacy talk, you know, when this finals takes place. You know, is Curry can't be an all-time great until he wins his second. Durant's gonna somehow be an entirely different player when he has a chance, you know, if he gets a championship. You know, then LeBron is either gonna win and beat an all-time team, and now we can realistically talk about him alongside Jordan. I think those are really sort of shallow, sort of almost lazy evaluations. You know, if you really want to dig into it, Jordan never, ever, 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 and this isn't an argument for LeBron or I've given up trying to say who's better. But Jordan, we can all agree, never had to play a team like the Warriors.
True.
Ever. Not even close.
True, yeah.
Jordan was even on a team like the Warriors. Forget, we're talking about four Hall of Famers. Now, those guys, stone cold, barring injury, are going to the Hall of Fame. Okay, so Jordan was playing, you know, a one-man. He was basically, you know, the Phoenix Suns with one superstar. Where would that get you these days? He was basically playing like the Rockets. You know, in the finals, they have Charles Barkley. They have one superstar. You know, he's being guarded by who? Like the Jeff Hornacek of the world,
right?
Brian Russell. I mean, think about the athletes that are being thrown at LeBron and the sophistication of the defenses. We're talking about a one-on-one isolation era that Jordan played in, and he's isolating against Jeff Hornacek. You know, against whoever's on Suns, Dan Majerle. You know, and this isn't a knock. I'm not trying to say LeBron is better than Jordan or vice versa, but I think that falling into the sort of romantic memory of Jordan that he never didn't have it for a game and he always won. Well, I'd like to see Jordan's finals record if he had to play those two Spurs teams and these two Warriors teams.
So would I. Yeah. Or I would settle for the Rockets. I would settle for the 94 Rockets.
Yeah, so just be careful with, well, Jordan always brought it, and when it was on the line, he never lost. Well, let me tell you something. If this Cleveland team or those Miami teams that LeBron was on was playing the end of Magic Johnson's run Lakers, the one superstar Charles Barkley's Suns, who else were they beating? The Sonics, you know? Let me tell you something. He wouldn't have lost either. So I just think that we need to be careful with every once in a while LeBron doesn't show. He does have those games, but I actually went back and I looked at a few of the Jordan ones, and there were some games against Seattle where he was like, I don't know, like six. I think he was like 6 for 19 in one
Gary
game.
Gary Payton did work. Gary Payton gave him the business for a couple of games.
It's not like every, you know, but as time goes on, we romanticize. And we sort of remember through, you know, selectively. And now we have this vision of Jordan that every single game was the flu game. You know, and he was dumping 40 every night and getting up 30 shots and just bringing all out. You know, there were plenty of games against lesser teams and lesser defenders where he wasn't Michael Jordan either. And I think right now the level of scrutiny that LeBron James is under, and we're doing it to other. We're starting to do it to Curry too. We're talking about a guy who's over the course of his playoffs is averaging, I think, 25, 26 a game, over 40% from three, 45 from the field, a dominant Hall of Fame caliber player in the playoffs, where he's facing defenses, and not only from a talent level, but from a scheme level, that are solely devoted to stopping him, that guys in the past have never faced, ever. And look at the playoffs Curry's having now. Is anyone talking about what he's doing right now? I think he's over 50% from three against in the last series. He's averaging close to, 30 a game in the conference finals. He's all world. But everybody's just waiting now for the finals to say whether or not we can actually talk about Curry as a great player. Like, if he doesn't shoot 50% from three and the Warriors lose the finals, well, no, Curry doesn't have. So we narrow all these arguments down to like one or two games, when anyone who's willing to have an honest conversation knows that these things are circumstantial. And listen, after this series, I'm going to think the same exact thing about LeBron James as a player. I'm going to think the same exact thing about Kevin Durant as a player. I'm going to think the same thing about Steph Curry as a player.
Okay. So that's kind of a first look at the finals. Obviously, we'll talk a lot more about this because we're going to have time. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been the CBS Sports Basketball Podcast. Brad, thanks for joining me.